This week on Decentralize, Ross Ulbricht and the consequences of living under a tyrannical government. Then we talk to Julia Turiansky of Brave the World.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm Chas Ferguson.
I'm James Walpole.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralize.
How's it going, everybody? I wanted to start today off by talking about an event that's happening in New York City right now called Exponential Finance, and it's actually being sponsored by CNBC and Singularity University. Singularity University have a very heavy influence by Ray Kurzweil, who's a hero of mine, and about 2 weeks ago, Augur, the company that I'm a part of, was accepted, and not only were we accepted as a part of the XCS challenge, but we were immediately, well not immediately, but somewhat immediately given given the finalist position, which ended up being a very great honor for the breakthrough technology category. So there is finance, there's financial, there is medical, and then there's breakthrough. Breakthrough is everything that's just really cutting edge and things that you know, aren't always easily fit, they can fit in one category. And the part two of what of all of the events and happenings is happening tomorrow. The Augur team that's in New York has had the opportunity to meet with some absolutely amazing people. This event is so cool, and I really want to encourage our listeners to check out every single company that's submitted there, because it really is more than Augur, obviously, and there's some really cool, interesting technologies out there. Some aren't interesting, but that's the thing, is everyone can find, you know, their beauty in whatever they dig and technologically wise. So I wanted to hype that up a little bit because it's something I've personally been very excited about and promoting the hell out of. What we're going to move on to is something that's a much more hot button issue, which is Ross. And I believe, James, you're going to go first.
Yeah, this is something we're talking about Ross Ulbricht here, and this is not really so much a hot button issue as like a kind of a tragedy, I think, for probably for all of us. And it does make me want to say something probably on camera, on a microphone that will be recorded that I can't take back, but which needs to be said here. Fuck the state. Because this is really something, this is taking a person's life and ruining it for, again, for a nonviolent crime. Ross, for any listeners who don't know, was sentenced to life in prison, accused DPR of the Silk Road, and we'll talk a little bit more to Julia Turiansky later in the show about this, but I've sort of been following this in the news, a lot of us have, and reading the proceedings of the sentencing, which was on Friday of last week, was pretty chilling. If you actually read the testimony of people there, if you read the what the judge said to Ross, how judges and witnesses called in to sort of give character witness responded to him. I don't know, it's very hard. It was very hard for me to read that because, I don't know, I'm having a hard time expressing this right now, as I'm sure our listeners can attest. It's hard for me to put it in words because we've been following this trial. We talked about it on the show before. We've talked about, you know, why, whether or not Ross obviously was guilty of being DPR, this is definitely not a case of someone bringing a violent institution to the world. This is a case of someone who set out to start an experiment of freedom, a decentralized experiment, who wanted to give people a chance to exit and create their own free situations. This is something we talk about in the show a lot, something we're all about. You can look on Ross's LinkedIn even now and see what he was envisioning, what he was planning publicly. He was just a guy like us. I think he's around 33 now, which is around sort of around Tony's age. And I don't know, he just wanted to make things freer. He's a lot like us in so many ways. Whether or not he was DPR or not, he had this strong kind of character from everyone who submitted letters on his behalf. I believe it was over 100 from his fellow inmates where he was being held. During this period, I mean, it's, and then obviously the characterizations by the judge. For those who want to read more about it, I would definitely check out Andy Greenberg's Wired coverage of this. But the characterization of Ross as a dangerous criminal, as a murderer based on, you know, uncharged allegations, as the characterization of him as being responsible for the deaths of people due to drug use. It was very draconian, and like, while again, I'll sort of stop here, but it's while I've been aware of what's going on, I've been troubled by it. I've been troubled by the precedent sets for anyone running a decentralized project. It's the abruptness of this, and like the absolute cruelty of sentencing someone to life in prison in a maximum security prison. Again, for non-violent charges in this case, and for someone who's running a decentralized project, that's something fundamentally like we think is a good and beneficial thing for society. It was a wake-up call to me, because I probably am definitely shielded from the direct effects of the state and the direct effects of centralized power. Like, it's true. I won't use the word privilege here, because it's a controversial word to use, but I'm fortunate enough in that I don't encounter that every day. I have the luxury of ignoring the state, and I definitely recommend anyone who has that luxury take it. Ignore the state. Don't make it part of your life. But it's definitely brought it home. I mean, this is one of us, if you want to put it that way. But more importantly, as a human being. So that's why I'm very sad, and why I say what I do. When I do say, you know, that we really see the enemy revealed plainly here.
Yeah, this is, in my opinion, a relic of a very draconian system. You can point your finger at this idea of the drug war being the problem here. Well, I think that the problem is much wider than that, and you start to see the reverberations of the more systemic issues, which are a result of corruption that manifests itself in any centralized power, in any centralized system. Some parts of that system will fail. Some parts of that system will not only fail, but will actively act against the original purpose of that organization. And subsequently, this reflects in a rotting, right? This rotting effect takes place in every empire in history. And we are starting to see it happen faster. In the same way that we see technology advancing faster and faster, we're starting to see the empires start to rot faster and faster. And this is something that struck me. Ross Ulbricht, whether he worked on, you know, Silk Road or not, you know, he's convicted in court of doing that. But what he was a peer. He was a person who is working on exactly the same kinds of projects that each and every one of us are working on today. And that is what strikes us so close to home, is this could be one of us that gets a black bag swooped over our heads at any moment in time and carried off to prison, right? And then be charged with crimes against this. I just want to share... I want to share exactly what James kind of talked about. And this is a quote from Ross's LinkedIn profile. And I quote, "I want to use economic theory as a means to abolish the use of coercion and aggression against mankind. Just as slavery has been abolished most everywhere, I believe violence, coercion, and all forms of force by one person over another can come to an end. The most widespread and systemic use of force is amongst institutions and governments. So this is my current point of effort. The best way to change a government is to change the minds of the governed, however. To that end, I am creating an economic simulation to give people a first-hand experience of what it would be like to live in a world without the systemic use of force."
What's really hard for me, I guess, is sort of like, I do... like looking at his picture, he's so young. He looks a little bit like me, sort of, in some ways, and he reminds me of me and what he's writing here. Because like the way I view sort of what I'm working on is the same way, like giving people the experience of freedom. That's my goal in it. And it's my goal, you know, with, I don't know, it's hard to see that. But it's definitely a very personal thing in a lot of ways, but also a very philosophical thing, as you said, Eric.
Okay, James, what you said was really gripping, first and foremost, and the emotion in your voice was unlike anything I've actually heard you speak before, and you usually speak with quite a bit of an emotion in your voice, and I've never heard you hear you drop an F-bomb, so I can tell how much it means to you, which is why, coming into this conversation, I'm going to be honest with you, I cared very little about the story. I saw it, I was very much just like, well, that sucks, like, no, he doesn't deserve it, but you know, there's bigger issues in the world. And then I heard you speak and the passion in your voice and how you really identified it. I think because of what we do with this podcast, because of, you know, what our jobs are. And it really made me think a little bit about, you know, placing yourself in that position. And and I was kind of taking notes too of things I wanted to mention. One of the things I wanted to mention, you immediately addressed before I said it, which was, here's one guy, oh, by the way, ridiculously overdone charge. I think everyone agrees with that. But he also is a white, middle-class guy, and that kind of thing happens all the time. If you are black, or if you are Hispanic, or if you are from the city I'm from, Detroit, where there's so many people that are incarcerated, and, you know, it did take this moment, I think, for you to probably identify. I don't know. Maybe it did. I don't want to put words in your mouth. It's a bad situation, and it's unjust, definitely. And when I first wanted to make a statement, I was excited because I was going to say I really don't care too much about this story. Unfortunately, I want to leave the story with that same attitude, and I'll tell you why. Is because I spent a lot of my life worrying about things I couldn't change, worrying about things that had little to no direct input on my life. They had indirect, and maybe there's things I can change a little bit about, which is what I try to do with things like this show, and, you know, Augur, whatever things we try to build. And you know, I try to do what I can, but I also have to admit what I can't control and what helps me sleep at night. And what really matters is the people that's just around me. And, you know, I think that's something where all the increased communication methods have really harmed who we are as people, because now we hear every single story that's as sad as Ross's, and we let it deeply emotionally get to us, instead of, you know, maybe the person that's across the room that really matters a lot. And that today is a profound day for me to say that in a different way, but that's really my mindset, and it was my mindset going into this story and coming out. But hearing how much it affected you, and you too, Eric, you know, you definitely had emotion in your voice, made me realize, you know, you never really know how something can affect someone else.
The thing for me here is, I got really struck by, you know, early in the Bitcoin ecosystem, Charlie Shrem, also tried and convicted, and is now serving time, right, for operating an exchange for people to trade Bitcoin. He had a similar idea, and I thought that was going to be, you know, the biggest thing that we saw, right? Okay, some of the early starters of some of these, you know, questionable Bitcoin things is being put in jail because the government wants to make examples of them. And what's been made evidence to me in this absurd case is that it gets bigger, right? Someone who genuinely had a morally positive, morally sound and secure way of making the world a better place is now in jail because the state recognizes that as a threat to their power. And subsequently, what they're doing is making an example of him and saying, hey, you know, if you're ever thinking of building a decentralized system, you better watch out because this is what's going to happen to you. This is absolutely a martyr charge. Nothing about the case was actually a fair trial. Nothing about the case, they never even brought any of the other charges to the table because they knew one important fact. And the fact was that there was more than one DPR. DPR is a title. It's not a person. It's a title handed from one person to another, frequently over time, that is just simply says, this is my mission at this time. When it is time for me to abdicate this position, I will. And it is there were several others involved in this case that are not being charged. Just because Ross was the one person that they could figure out how to put a finger on and they could construct a case around him, they're sentencing him for two life sentences and then several decades of additional charges just to make an example of him, to discourage people from creating similar types of free commerce and liberty-based systems, systems that are against violence. You've got Ross, who's now in jail for eliminating violence in the streets, preventing violence in the streets, saving countless lives, while the people who are supposed to be enforcing the laws and eliminating violence in the streets, people are supposed to be doing what Ross did, are out in the streets beating and murdering people, right? In riots, they're beating and murdering people, macing them in the face without any justification. And that is just, that is the state that we're living in right now. And it just like fires, it really pisses me off.
And I did, when I wanted to make a quick reply, and I still want to make two now, because that last thing you said is true. They are macing people in the face, but to be fair, the people that are macing in the face are the ones that put themselves in the position to be maced by protesting. Now, I'm not saying they shouldn't protest, but what I'm saying is they're putting themselves in that position. Now, the other thing I wanted to say, which I think is much more important, is someone whose treatment gets me fired up in the same way that both of you, and that's Bradley Manning. And that's someone who's kind of faded into obscurity. And what happened to him, I think, is a much bigger travesty. And we all have opinions. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I think they're both, you know, ridiculous stories. You're right, it is Chelsea Manning. And, you know, what was it, 25 years for exposing, you know, murders that were done by our military? And there's people that can defend that sentence, and that makes me sick. And there's so many sentences that make me sick like that. And that's sometimes why, and I hate to say this because it shows my weakness, that I just back off and try not to pay attention to it.
Look, this is obviously is not the first, this is not the last, people to be thrown in jail for trying to make the world genuinely, morally, a better place. Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, all of these people are being aggressively persecuted by the powers that be, that just simply for making the world a better place. This is absurd. I cannot fathom what it took to get us in this scenario other than complacency and ignorance and cowardice to not fight against the first instance that people see of abuse of power. You have to fight against the very first, like, violent oppression of any sort, whether, like, in any capacity. Otherwise, it expands and it grows and it festers and it becomes this giant leviathan of the state that we have today.
I think power's always been with us. It's always been very bad. But I would make the argument that we're seeing a greater rise in the number of really young people, or just people in general, who have the self-conception of freedom, who know that they're sovereign individuals and know they can do this, they can take these stands. It's encouraging to me, but not how they're being treated, obviously. And again, that does sort of strike deeply. What Tony said, you know, I guess I do identify with them, but it reminds me that I need to identify with everyone who's going through this. It reminds me why I'm a radical. Because I generally would side with Tony. I want to build our projects of peace and not go out in the streets and like fight anyone. I still don't want to fight anyone. I don't believe in violence, but and I don't believe in politics. I don't believe in any direct way we could change it. But we can do these small things. I mean, we can do the big things like Snowden did. We can do the small things like supporting these people and talking about them. We can do things like what Lynn Ulbricht's doing, his mother, who's just nonstop fighting to get him get a retrial. Not a retrial anymore, so much as an appeal for the sentencing. But it's something. This is a personal thing. It's not so much for me, at least. It's not so much a big, massive conflict. I mean, like you said, we're seeing trends for power and for people fighting back against it. But again, ultimately, I think it's just important to remember the humanity in all of this. And I know that sounds very philosophical and very high level, but it's true. I mean, like, that's, if we want to take what Ross said, I mean, it's the experience of freedom that makes people realize things about themselves, and it's the experience of people like Ross. And I do take it that he's a noble person. It's the experience of people like that that I think changes people's minds. And hopefully will change some of this trend we're seeing toward just aggressive crackdown. But even if it doesn't, it'll make life better for us and make us better people, I think.
And in response to the fighting back is what we need to do, I would disagree with that. I think creating a better alternative is what we should be doing. Because fighting back will do nothing but make them oppress us more. And also, someone like Snowden did so much more than the entirety of the Occupied movement. That one act that Snowden did much more. It's not only symbolically, but actually in what we know. And that's why I don't think going in the streets and being confrontational against paid government agents who are given all kinds of weapons and that can out-muscle and out-power you.
No one's suggesting that, Tony. Let's be very clear here.
Okay, like, okay.
No one's suggesting that. That's completely off base.
Okay.
It's not our mission or what we talk about here on the show.
But when I hear fight back, that's what I think. I think protesting, I think Ferguson.
The way to fight back for anyone listening is to go and build new systems that simply abstain from the state, that make the state irrelevant, because the state is irrelevant. We have the power, we have the technology within our grasp to immediately build a better system that completely disallows completely any sort of act of violence against other individuals in this capacity. Like, it just eliminates it.
So, Eric, I guess the question would be now, seeing sort of how these central powers react to people like Ross and how this has been sort of like some kind of a show trial, show sentencing with perhaps the purpose of making an example. We can make that assumption, I guess, safely, even from the words of the judge herself. How do entrepreneurs and thinkers out there, people who, again, maybe are building things, we're working in decentralized spaces. We're not building the same kind of stuff Ross is building, the same kind of stuff, which actually is very dangerous to the state. but we are all doing things now which are very much in their minds, I guess. How can people minimize the downside of political oppression in this sort of weird age we're entering into, where maybe the state's sort of being a little bit more aggressive against decentralized projects?
The best way to do that is to be very principled in your approach to privacy and security. By making it impossible for them to even consume or detect or identify that you are the person behind this, they won't have anyone to attack. So I disagree a little bit with Tony in saying that Occupy didn't have a meaning. I think it set a very fertile ground for all of the things that have happened very quickly in the past 5 years, right? That what is happening is people recognize the power of anonymity, right? Through something literally called anonymous. This idea that emerged that the state or a centralized power cannot kill an idea. And so long as they cannot identify who is propagating that idea, it is impossible for them to fight back in any meaningful capacity against it. So as an entrepreneur, as a developer, as a evangelist of technology, as a libertarian, even as a basic citizen who just happens to be aware of what's going on out there, because how could you not at this point, be very principled in your approach to making sure that what we're building is an anonymous, secure, and decentralized system. Those are the three core tenets that I stick with. Secure in the sense that in order to intercept those communications, you have to break this impossible math problem. No matter how much violence, you cannot solve that math problem. No matter how much violence you bring to the table, you can't break that math problem. Secure. Anonymous, in the sense that rather than tying people to real name policies and doing document verification, you know what? Build a better system. Allow people, embrace this idea of privacy and liberty, privacy, right? Embrace this idea that what people are bringing to the value table when they're engaging in commerce, which is why Bitcoin became such a very big thing and why we are actually working directly on things that that matter in this capacity, embrace this idea that what they're bringing to the table is simply value, right? All of these concepts is essential. And if you're building anything that eliminates that single point of authority, the decentralized piece, it makes it possible, or makes it impossible for any one attack to take down the system, right? And that is an engineering concept that I think could be applied to sociological systems, can be applied to political systems. Eliminate points of central authority, and you will build a much more resilient system. It will become impossible to take down. So those three core principles.
Amen to the principles, and my one core piece of advice that has made me happy is this one sentence, which is, politics is the mind killer. Focus on what makes you happy. That's it.
So abstain from it.
Yeah, abstain from the horrible things. I mean, again, this is like a very, very sad thing, but there are so many sad things going on. And we can be encouraged by the good things that are going on, by the things that are being built. And yes, we definitely, I think most if not all of us here would definitely be very supportive of freeing Ross. We certainly hope something like that happens with the appeal, and hopefully it can be helpful in that sense on the political level. But hopefully it's just sort of a hopefully what you said here is helpful. Decentralized listeners, we're really just dealing with our own emotions on the issue right now, and sort of sorting through our thoughts on it, because it's definitely an issue which I think is going to affect a lot of us going forward. Definitely going to affect me, but as I said, it's sort of re-radicalized me, and I'm ready to go out and decentralize more things, and we hope you'll join us.
Today we're joined by Julia Toriansky, who's a self-described anarchist whose goal is to influence the denial of assumed power structures. She's a centerpiece of Brave the World, a popular YouTube channel covering anarchy and other exits from the system. Welcome to the show, Julia.
Thanks for having me.
So, all right, tell us, what exactly is Brave the World?
You summed it up pretty well. It's just anything that I find worthwhile exploring and delving into, and sometimes standing up in the name of or against. So, I don't know. In the past, I've attended like CPAC and have asked very anarchistic questions. That was fun. That was one of my first projects. I did the protests at Bilderberg. I've been following the Silk Road case and doing some, I guess, reporting, but more, I don't like to use the word reporting because I think journalists are blood-sucking scum. It's more of a moral support and ethical support in the name of free speech. So, yeah, I mean, I could go on, but I think that's good enough.
So, Julia, where does the name Brave the World come from? Does it have an origin that means something to you?
Yes, so everyone knows Brave New World, right? So instead of a Brave New World, instead of embracing a Brave New World, we should brave the world and go in the opposite direction.
Very cool. And I actually had a question about what you were speaking on a few moments ago, and it had to do with your protesting Bilderberg and also your hatred of journalists, because I think that there are awesome journalists and poor journalists like anything else. So why is it that it took journalists so long to even figure out that Bilderberg is a thing?
Because this is the kind of stages of the status quo that we get fed. So what you have first is complete denial. Right? They deny that something's happened completely. Once that becomes harder to do, they label you as conspiracy theorists and say, oh, it's an over-dramatization. Once that becomes apparent that it's not true again, they accept that the reality, and they accept that we know the reality, but they normalize it. So Bilderberg, oh, it's no big deal. It's just a meeting of powerful people, and families and politicians and those companies that are in charge of manufacturing arms, meeting with potential presidents. No big deal. Oh, and nobody ever really knows when and where, and the list is secret, and they block off entire public streets and roads, but it's no big deal. Oh, and your taxes pay for it. No big deal. And your taxes also pay for their security. I believe the Copenhagen one cost over 100,000 euros just for security. And when I was there, I actually vined an endless stream of high protection armored vehicles coming in and out of Bilderberg, the hotel that they were doing it at. So,
you still with us, Julia?
Uh-huh.
Okay, cool. It sounded like you trailed off there for a second.
Yeah, I don't remember the question now. I went on a tangent. I may have answered it.
Bilderberg tends to get anyone going on a tangent, myself included. So it's a fascinating thing.
Right. And journalists.
Yes.
Right. So again, and journalism has taken, like I've been saying this for a little while now. Journalism used to be a profession where it was okay to have a bias and an opinion. It was, in fact, encouraged. Now, to have a bias or an opinion is wrong. That's bad journalism. But the very fact that we deny that there's always a bias and then there's always an opinion when a journalist writes is more dishonest than having an outright bias. So when you have something like a very obvious conflict and you give both sides of the story, even though one is obviously in the wrong, I think that's morally reprehensible, and I think that it's dishonest because you're giving the same weight to something that might not deserve the same weight. So the entire concept of journalism has been bastardized to me, and I hate when I'm called a journalist, and even the journalists that are independent and in the libertarian and anarchist communities, I've learned to disrespect a lot of them as well because I've personally experienced some very dishonest activity.
So that's really interesting. There's behind, let's say, the Bilderbergs, right? There's like this core philosophy that it seems like you sort of centered a lot of your work around. Could you describe for our listeners sort of what is it about, bad actors in journalism, bad actors at the Bilderberg system that you're really getting at here philosophically?
Well, what I understand having a kind of motivational factor of gain, right? So, but it's become the sole purpose of people being a journalist. So you get even people that are supposed to be more morally honest and doing good, like people in the libertarian movement, that is the standard they claim to be on, you know, non-aggression, you know. They're not profit, but I keep seeing people solely focusing on clickbait. And recently something happened where there was a private letter that Ross Ulbricht sent to a very popular libertarian radio show to an individual from that show saying, thanks for supporting me, blah, blah, blah. And he said a few private things in the letter which were meant to be private. And they went and published it as a headline saying, a first public letter from Ross Ulbricht. That is incredibly inappropriate. And the things that were in the letter actually had the potential of hurting him because of the position he's in. His lawyers were very worried, and his mother asked the people directly to take it down, and they wouldn't take it down until Ross spent his call quota and his own money, which he has almost none left, to call them and ask them to take it down. So I'm seeing this dishonesty in the name of profit, even in our own community. And Ross has written, they are not the first people to get a letter from Ross. I know many people that have gotten letters from Ross, and they did not go ahead and publish it. I did not publish my letters on my blog from Ross because I assumed that they're private.
You know, and I think that the main word there is assume when it comes to that. And it's really interesting when it comes to private communication as what is private and what is public. And it really comes down to what you make private and what you make public. And I'm probably the oddest one of the whole decentralized group here because I have not made a certain – I haven't taken a stance on the Ross situation because I think obviously what he did – is, you know, the freedom part of me says, oh, who cares, it's to each his own, but then the other part of me goes, well, when you play with fire and you get burned, and then you see that he got life in prison, and I as a taxpayer have to pay for that, that is what bothers me actually the most. So I'm actually, you know, very interested in that more than anything else is the sentence.
Well, you should be upset with the state for having to pay those taxes, not with Ross, right?
Absolutely, and that's, yeah, it's absolutely, and the judge.
Mm-hmm, and, I mean, the whole, I've had two interviews before this, too, and there's one thing I just keep reiterating. The whole thing of whether Ross is guilty or not, and there's been a lot of finger-pointing at his supporters saying that we've been inconsistent. One minute he's non-DPR, the next minute he's is DPR, but go anti-drug war. We have not changed our tune. His supporters maintain that he's innocent. And let me explain what we mean by innocent. If Ross is DPR the whole time, started it throughout, the only person who was DPR, if he was DPR some of the time and multiple DPRs are involved, if he wasn't DPR at all, all of those make him still innocent. Because at the end of the day, the Silk Road reduced harm, saved lives, and took violence off the streets. That is not even negotiable. So in an ethical sense, he is innocent. In the law sense, he's guilty. But, you know, so are people in that follow the Muslim religion and are under Muslim law that drink breast milk on the third full moon of the year, they're guilty to be punishable by death. So, I mean, if you're guilty by law, anything could be made illegal, right?
This whole trial situation and sentencing with Ross just really has me sick to my stomach, and it's been pretty upsetting for a lot of people, I'm sure. I understand you were at the trial. Were you also present at the sentencing? And can you tell us a little bit about your experience with either of those?
Yeah, I was at the trial, and if anybody wants to just get up to date with how it went down, I have like very thorough videos on my channel, and it's Brave the World channel on YouTube. You can just search it; it's easy, or my website bravetheworld.com. But yeah, the trial itself was daunting. They really dragged it out. The prosecution was very brutal, and they pandered to their audience, which was a jury of his peers, which was not, because they were all, most of them were government workers and very basic people. Not to be rude, but a jury of his peers would be at least university graduates, at least people that are somewhat technologically savvy, at least people that are under 40 years old. So it was not a jury of his peers. So the entire process was pretty horrific. And again, the behavior from journalists was incredibly inappropriate. I was misquoted. Lynn was misquoted. And then the same people who misquote us for their clicks come to our faces and say, oh, can I get another interview with you? So, I mean, that was not a fun time. I did get a flight to go see him during the sentencing. But then the sentencing changed after I already booked my flight, and I just didn't have the means to change it back, and I decided to go home instead.
So one of the things you talked about a little bit earlier was this idea that things can be against the law by the state or by a central authority, but still morally correct, right? Or morally, or the inverse, things can be morally wrong and still perfectly legal. One of the things I think you pursued, a lot of people pursued very early on in sort of the trial, was this idea of jury nullification, where if the jury feels that the law itself is unjust, they can, you know, not convict the person of the court. They can actually basically nullify that law for that sentence.
Yeah. And that's a constitutional right. But the judge, right before the jury went to deliberate, she actually said, "You even if you don't agree with the law, you still have to judge according to the law." So she was alluding to the fact that jury nullification exists. She knew that most of those people are uninformed, but she still took the precaution to dismiss any, you know, cloudiness in their mind in case they were leaning in that direction. So she was very adamant about being against the concept of jury nullification. The law's the law, and, you know, he did this, this, and this, therefore he broke this, this, and that law, therefore he's guilty. Morality or, you know, that did not counter in at all.
Yeah, it was kind of tragic, and now it's kind of an inverse state where the state is the one committing the violence against a morally innocent individual, right? And that's sort of the travesty of it all. What is the role? Go ahead.
He's a nonviolent criminal. Okay,
exactly.
He's a criminal by the law. He's a nonviolent criminal with no history, and he's going to be sent to a maximum security prison for life with rapists and sociopaths and murderers. Like, that is a complete infringement on any kind of human rights, even by the most, like, by the most basic standards.
Well, and what's interesting is in the community, you know, everybody feels that he largely helped remove violence from the system. So what do you think is the role? What can we gain from this, and what can we do today, first and foremost? And then what can we do to make sure that things like this absurdity doesn't ever happen again?
Jeffrey Tucker wrote a cool article, and he named Ross Ulbricht the Socrates of today, and he named all of these historic characters that were prosecuted for being, you know, a trailblazer and making, like, a watershed in history because of their achievement. And then we look back on it, and we're like, oh, we probably shouldn't have punished them for doing what they did. And, you know, he's being very positive, and he hopes that'll be the case. I would love to believe that, but I see where, you know, where America's moving, what direction it's moving in, and I think it's just becoming more morally bankrupt, and I think people, you know, a lot of these people who are anti-Silk Road or anti-Ross, a lot of them are like these liberal atheists, right? And liberal atheists pride themselves on not needing a god or a higher power, right? They pride themselves on thinking for themselves. Yet, they're actually replacing the belief in God. And originally, Christianity was very anarchistic, and Christians were prosecuted for not worshiping the state in Rome. And if you read anything that Jesus said, he was a total anarchist and anti-authoritarian and pro-peace and non-violence. And these very same people just replace religion with the worship for the state, which is a million times worse. And then they think that they're these progressive, forward-thinking individuals. And a lot of them, you know, a lot of them should be anti-drug war, right? And a lot of them are anti-drug war. But no, it doesn't count for the Silk Road because Ross made a profit, and profit is evil. Because they're all socialists. So somehow, because Ross made a profit from the Silk Road, negates any good that the Silk Road did.
Exactly.
And, yeah. And, you know, as a follow-up, something you said a moment ago, too, when you were talking about the sentencing and, you know, just how he was sentenced with murderers, rapists, violent criminals, I think that actually is something more than being morally bankrupt is really the prison industrial complex, as people like to call it, and there's a profit incentive there. And how do you feel about that? Do you feel this is something that's isolated with Ross, or do you feel this is something that is a bigger problem?
Well, specific to Ross, he's being crucified to set an example. That's all. Like, I knew he was going to get life. I didn't want to say, like, I wanted, you know, I tried to have hope before it's completely, you know, in stone, and I still have hope for the appeal process. Because on paper, there is, like, so many brass hooks to hang an appeal on. But I think he was made an example of. And I think Judge Forrest's only job, because of her influence from Chuck Schumer, was to make an example of him. And that's just the sad circumstance of his existence. He was the first, and he's going to be adequately punished, and everyone's going to know, and there's going to be a media campaign against him, and they're going to slander him to the point of labeling him as a murderer, whether or not it was proven. There wasn't even bodies, and the site was ran by their own feds at that point, and it's quite obvious that they faked it by now.
Yeah, what I found so surreal was the difference in sentencing, right? So he's not only being two life sentences, and I think an additional like 40 or 50 years, but he's also being held accountable for the entirety of the gross revenue of the platform. So for all of the dealers on the platform, he now owes a perpetual debt to the state to pay the state, not even victims, not even like... there were no victims. It was a victimless crime. Uh-huh. Not even to go to like drug prevention, right?
Well, the government's a mafia, and he went and became independent, and they want their cut. That's all. They want their cut, and they're going to get it. And I think part of it, too, is they just always wanted their cut, and the only way to get it is to crucify Ross. I mean, you want to talk about the evils of money and profit? Government, number one.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about, is this a Western phenomenon? Is this limited to America? Is this limited to Western states? Or is this more of a global concern?
What do you mean by this? Like the perversion
aggression
of the justice?
The violent aggression of the state against its citizens.
I think America is one of the newer countries to do this. Like, America used to be quite a free, independent, moral country, you know, honor thy neighbor. Like, America was very, you know, there's a reason why it prospered so fast, because it was so free market and non-aggressive. And, you know, obviously they had the revolutions and the slavery, but the people's individual moral compass was quite strong. And you can't forget that the slavery went hand in hand with the state, right? As you know, there's so many complex issues. But generally, America, compared to the history of a lot of countries, America's a new country, was okay. And now it's like the worst of them all, obviously. But yeah, of course. As long as humans have existed, there have been states, and as long as states have existed, they have been violent. Look at Russia, look at China, you know, look at Latin America. It's conquest and conquer, and look at England. Look at the history of England. And there, you know, in terms of police state and ridiculous laws, they almost outdo America.
It seems what's so compelling about Ross is that he's so much the opposite of that. I mean, even just looking at his persona publicly, his LinkedIn profile is still alive. You can look at it now and see, you know, he wanted to make the world a freer place by giving people the opportunity to be free. I mean, that's very close to like what I hold as my ideal. It's very hard to see someone like this, as you say, really being crucified. And I know you've been working very closely with his mother, Lynn, who's been... obviously spreading this word and trying to free your son. What can maybe listeners who feel the same way do to support the family, to support the legal fund, whether monetarily or just through words of support?
FreeRoss.org, please donate, because the appeal process takes a year or more, and it's costing her a lot for the lawyer fees. Like, it's really, really expensive. Remember, the state has all the money in the world, and they do not. I'm doing a little project that people will still have time to contribute to if they like. I probably won't send it off till Friday, but I'm compiling a care package for him of screenshots of all the nice and supportive comments and articles that I've seen in his favor across the last few days. Because, you know, imagine being in this vacuum. Like, look, like, how often do you guys go on Facebook or Twitter or whatever social media you go on, like, a day to, like, just to, like, reassure yourself that you exist and, you know, to have your social connections and to feel in in contact with the world. Ross hasn't gotten to do that in, you know, over a year. And when there's a media brigade outside and he knows that he's being talked about and he can literally feel it, I mean, that must be a horrible feeling to be so cut off from the world. So I want to give him a glimpse into how much support he's been getting.
That's really awesome, and we really appreciate, you know, what you're doing to sort of get the word out, and not only with the Ross Ulbricht case, but with things like the BitLicense and elsewhere. And we'd sort of like to talk about a few of the other projects you're working on.
Sure, just before, like, if anybody wants to add a comment or, like, their experience, or I've been getting some experiences from people who bought pharmaceutical drugs that weren't available in America and have, like, saved their families' lives and reduced suffering. They're, like, really heartbreaking stories. So if anybody has anything like that, just tweet it at me, at Brave the World. Or, like, I mean, I know there's a comment section there, and you can link my website. They can email me through my website as well.
Well, we should include that link in our show notes. We definitely encourage anyone interested to do that. So we did want to ask you, sort of going back and circling back around, how you really began all this activism in the first place. I know you sort of began with your first video at CPAC probably about 2 years ago, I'm guessing. But sort of how did it come to this point for you? Because now you're very much involved in a lot of these very high-profile cases. What attracted you to filmmaking and sort of drove you to take this all you do?
So I had my Brave the World Twitter account like for 6 months prior to doing anything on YouTube. And I would write for Mises Canada sparsely and go to the meetings. And I just got, people don't really read articles unless like you get lucky and it goes really viral, or unless you're an amazing writer. And, you know, I'm decent. I'm not, you know, that great. So just like I felt that I could reach people in a different way. And then I helped organize Liberty Now in Toronto, and I met some really cool people while I was there. And, you know, I almost, one of them who, like, I greatly, you know, I thought he accomplished quite a lot for his age, said something to me that I don't think he even meant to, like, encourage me or anything, but he said something so flippantly and matter-of-factly, like, oh, well, why don't you just do this? Like, it felt like I could just do that. Why not? And I had been thinking about it anyways. So I actually, at that point, already had my first script, which was my first video, which was a pro-gun video, and it's under a minute long, and it went really big. So I got really lucky with that, because my first video that had me in it went really big. Prior to that, I had two videos that are like compilation videos, which I still really love. So if you get a chance to check out like my first two videos, that'd be really fun. But yeah, so that's how I did it. And you know, I had a little bit of experience when I was like 16, 17 on YouTube. I was part of anyone a gamer here? Anyone played Half-Life? Yeah. So I was in the Escape for City 17 short video that was based on the Half-Life universe, and that went viral. It was the number one video in all of North America for a week straight on YouTube. And so that almost like took my fear away from being online and on camera. So I guess all of those things combined, and here I am.
That's awesome. It's always fun like hearing people's backstories and like how they just have discovered these things. So moving into like some sort of defense mechanisms, right? So there's a lot of listeners out there who are aiming at solving problems like Ross was, like some of the things that you talk about, right? What are some of the things we can do to protect ourselves moving forward to make sure that we don't succumb to the violence of the state?
Well, I think art is not only a reflection of culture, it's a driver of culture. So that's very important. Technology is a very literal reaction to our environment and also driver into our future, which I'll leave it up to guys like you. You know, please use some decentralized innovations to, you know, change the power structures of our future. That'd be awesome. I'll just keep being loud and promote things. You guys can actually do the hard work. So, I mean, those two things in combination, you know, the art form plus the literal and technical, I think they can't exist to their full impact without each other. And you know, art, when I say art, that includes writing and ideas and awareness, as much as I hate that term, but you know, in the spreading of information that's not just dictated by our assumed power structures.
So Julia, you also mentioned wanting to discuss a recent video of yours, and sort of as we wrap up the show here, maybe we can preview a little bit of what you're working on for our listeners. You recently made a video about Rojava, which is an autonomous region in northern Syria, Kurdistan, I believe. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and what attracted your interest to it?
Yeah, for sure. I'm part of the Unsystem mailing list, and there's been, you know, people link things and talk about things a lot, and we were talking about Rojava for quite maybe like 6 months now, and people were sharing links and all this, and I just got into it and I looked at it, and you know, it's, you know, everyone always says, oh, give me an example of anarchism that works, haha, and it's hard unless you look back in history, right? But there it is. It's a very interesting combination of communalism, anarchism, and direct democracy. They have no state. They have no tax. They have very local, it's not governments. They have like local administrations for every street. So you can go, it's very, very local based. So any conflict you resolve with your neighbors first, and then it's delegated up. And, you know, at the top you have people, again, for every area, and it's three people, and each one of them has to be from a different ethnic background, and one of them at least has to be a female. So it's like very, very democratic in that sense, because the representation isn't skewed in any way. And for that region, it's very important, because think of where this is happening. This is in the border of Turkey and Syria during a Islamic State attack, and these people are completely equal in gender and ethnicity and creed and religion and all of these things. It's insane for this area, right? And they're living peacefully amongst themselves, and they're the only boots on the ground against ISIS. And what is NATO doing? Nothing. They're not supporting them with aid. They're not giving them weapons. They're doing absolutely nothing, because Turkey has labeled them as terrorists, because Turkey has a history of oppressing the Kurdish people to the point of not even giving them the recognition of a culture, and not letting them have education in their own language, or even naming their kids as, you know, after Kurdish names. So this is the petty crap that we're dealing with. Meanwhile, these people, there's like 2 million of them. It's three cantons. It's Rojava altogether, but it's three separate cantons that, you know, they go in between. They're actually, it's a complete feat in political and socioeconomic organization.
Okay, Julia, it seems like you're a total faucet of knowledge and wisdom and insight into the things that are going on here. Can you tell us where can people find more of you? Share your YouTube channel, your Twitter. What are those links, and where can people find you?
BraveTheWorld.com. And from there, you can find everything else that's me. Twitter is at Brave the World. YouTube channel, Brave the World channel. And what else? Facebook, I have a Facebook page. You can just search Brave the World on there. Yeah. Follow,
okay,
support.
Great.
If you're very rich, donate a little. If you're not very rich, you know, leave me a nice comment.
I especially liked your comment about how more than just technical people can contribute to the ecosystem, like what you're doing. If you're shouting from the hilltops, you're spreading knowledge and information, and that's just as powerful as the technology itself. Both need to exist, and more, for this movement to be successful.
So Julia, thank you so much for your time today. Our listeners have very much enjoyed it.
You're welcome.
to reap is what you sow!
What you reap is what you sow!